Did you know the demographic shift in the nation shows that the future of America is linked to the progress of the Latinx students? How does that affect your child, listener? Let me break it down for you. In 2011, more brown babies were born than white babies. In 2014, the minority population started turning into the majority. Latino growth data is way higher. This is significant to our education conversation today. Welcome to Educa K-16, an educational podcast with the vision to raise awareness on providing high quality education via our public education system in the United States of America. We exist as a call to action to inspire our listeners to get involved. And we want to walk along with you to advance the conversation on educational transformation and systemic change that needs to take place in our nation. The music you heard today, by the way, shout out to Dave Kemp from DTO Music. He's an award-winning music producer who designs inspirational music, raising the vibrations around the planet. Check him out on Instagram, search DTO Music. Welcome again to all our listeners in the North, East, West, and South of the United States. Today starts a series of episodes where we're talking about Latinos in education. We hope to ignite a powerful conversation that supports policymakers, politicians, students, teachers, superintendents, to keep the core of their decisions thinking of the students, not thinking of parties, not thinking of anything else, but keep the students at the core of your conversations. My distinguished guest is a leading expert in education in our nation, Dr. Abdinoa Rios. He is listed in the Who's Who in the Southwest and Men of Achievement. Welcome, Dr. Abdinoa Rios.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dr. Abdinoa Rios, you are a native of Puerto Rico, raised in the Bronx, New York, and Chicago, Illinois. You have been in the fields of education and psychology for more than 30 years. You're considered a leading education expert in Latinos in education. Most recently, you've written two books about Latinos in education. I've read partial of the other one, of your second book. I'm almost finished with the second book. The first book is a historical background of mostly Puerto Ricans and Mexicans, and the other book sheds light unveiling the 10 major challenges facing American education today. Before we dive into your books, before we go deeper, the listeners want to get to know you a bit more. You've earned 6 degrees from various universities such as Berkeley in California, Harvard University. What happened in the Bronx and Chicago that propelled you to get 6 degrees coming from Puerto Rico? Our audience wants to know about you a bit more. Please tell us.
I'm not sure what happened. Part of it was luck, happenstance, and part of it was because I was a very terrible sports person. I could not play baseball, certainly not football, and I wasn't all that great in track and field and everything else, and it was a barrio school, so I figured, okay, so if I can't make it that way, maybe I can make it by way of achievement, because I was also a lousy fighter in the gangs there. I would always lose out. And in the baseball.
Wait a minute. Our audience, is intrigued by what you just said. You were in the barrios and you were a lousy fighter in the gangs. Can you expand a little bit on that? What is a barrio, first of all? Let's educate our audience.
In the inner city where the Latino population lived in my particular sector in Chicago, we were gang infested. That is, our survival was gangs. In my case, it was about a 3-square block where Puerto Ricans were. And then it was adjacent to the Italian neighborhood on one side and adjacent to an African-American neighborhood on the other side and adjacent to a Mexican neighborhood on another side. And the Latinos and the Puerto Ricans were recent newcomers. The Mexicanos had been there for like two generations. They did not speak Spanish. We did not speak English. And so we would fight among ourselves, como Latinos, ironically, at that time. Then on the other side, there were the Italians, and then
the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? This continues.
Was the Capone area. This was where Al's Beef began in Chicago. So that was the Ambrose gang. And if anybody knows about gangs, and I talk a little bit about it in my second book, you have to realize that we were the newcomers as Puerto Ricans. And so as a result of all of that, it was bedlam. I mean, everybody had to fend for themselves. And so we, whether we liked it or not, we were involved in a gang, whether we were members or not. I mean, that's how it was. And so it was the Latin Kings for us. And I was a lousy fighter. And my uncle, who was only 3 years older than me, would be the ones that would always take my place when we fight it one-on-one, just for survival. And so I was not good at any of those. And so I thought, well, maybe I can be good in achievement in school. And
fantastic,
so
fantastic shift.
My work in school for fights on the ground, on the field, on the schoolyard.
Wow, I'm impressed. You came out of neighborhoods that were very challenging, and you decided to change your thought of staying in that. Instead, you went into achievement and succeeding in your education as a way out. So I want to talk.
This is important to share.
Yes.
Is that in fourth grade, my father decided to come back to Puerto Rico. So he took me back to Puerto Rico in fourth grade, which was a cultural change for me of immense proportions, because I had to sort of relearn Spanish all over again and unlearn my English. Turned out my father did not do well in a company he had set up. It went bankrupt. So he came back to the States, back to the same neighborhood within a year. So here I was now in fourth grade. I was again going to fifth grade. And I went back to the same elementary school, and they put me back 2 years.
Oh,
and my brother said, no, wait a second. We missed 1 year, but how can you put him back 2 years? Well, apparently that's what it was normally for everybody coming from Puerto Rico. So my father argued the case. He finally half won the case, and I was only put back 1 year, the 1 year that I was out. And I was very upset at that, because I had already gotten to know my friends that were in second, third grade from the previous years. I was no longer back in my cohort, and that made me very angry. And I thought, and they gave me an IQ test, by the way, which I didn't know until many years later. I did very well on the IQ test, but no matter, that was the policy of the school. So I talked to the principal, and my father talked to the principal, and finally, the principal said to just kind of go with it, because I will make it up later and so forth and so on. And I decided I was going to show my principal that I really deserved to have been a year ahead. And so I became an overachiever just to show off, just to show her that I could do it. And I guess the next 4 years were quite good for me. I became valedictorian of the class.
Wow.
Again, because I strived so hard, I proved my point.
That's fantastic.
I still lost the year. I did not make up that year until I got into
it. Right, but you're telling us a compelling story for our listeners out there, that they have their children in the inner city, that they have children that are struggling. You know, you can change it around with your thoughts and your perseverance. So I'm curious, because you mentioned how back in the barrio, the Latinos were fighting amongst themselves. And that brings me up to the word Latino. Let's go into, for our listeners, they're curious about the terminology. So who are you referring to when you write a book about Latinos in education? Are these students American students? What does the word Latino mean? Break it down for our audience.
Good question, tough answer. Latinos are people who come from a Spanish ancestry, but they vary considerably. They vary considerably in terms of the country. Where exactly are we talking about in terms of Latinos? They vary considerably in terms of knowledge of even the Spanish language. They vary in terms of multiple generations. We have those who just came recently, those who have been here for one generation, those who have been here for three, four, and those who were here even before the pilgrims. So it varies quite a bit. And we use the term generically to mean people of Spanish background. And so in a nutshell, the word was Latino in many respects. Later, the census came in, and by the way, we were not counted. In the 1960s and the 1970s, we were not really counted in the census. We were not part of the census.
So was it called Latinos back then?
No, it was not. It was people who were of Spanish origin, people who had Spanish surnames, believe it or not. That was one category of the census at one time. So it counted some Filipinos who had a Spanish surname but were not Hispanic. Later in the mid-70s, there was a concern that now the number of Hispanics were large in this country, and they came up with a census category that eventually evolved into Hispanic as a category. And that was in 1974. So the 1980 census for the first time fully counted 100% people of Hispanic background.
So I remember in the 80s, because I was in high school, I remember filling out forms and having Cuban American, Puerto Rican American, Hispanic, like differences, like they weren't counted as, you know, one group. And then in other forms, it was all bunched together, Hispanics for every. So what is that evolution? Because now we call Latinx. Can you go there?
I don't use the term Latinx. And I'll tell you why I don't use the term Latinx. Because I'm in Puerto Rico right now, and Latinx makes no sense whatsoever. I go to Latin America, and Latinx makes no sense. It's not a Latino word. So when we say Latino in general, we're meaning males and females. When we speak individually, then it's Latino or Latina, Hispano or Hispana. But we don't differentiate when we talk generically. And by the way, that's why we are a romantic language. We are romance language. I mean, Rusia is a female. The United States is a male. So we don't change gender based on how we feel. And we don't put an X behind any of them because that's extremely confusing. That does not exist in the Spanish language. So right. I use the term Latino, sometimes Hispanic. But Latino has become more the mode the last several decades since the 1980s, when Hispanic was the mode. So, and technically, by the way, there are certain Hispanic groups, like in sections of New Mexico, sections of even Colorado, where they refuse to use the term Latino, because they perceive themselves to be pure Hispanic descent from the 1500s. And some of them have traced their genealogy quite far back. And so they refuse to be called Latino. Son puro, pure, Hispano, Hispanic. And so, but with that, those exceptions, and that's very, very few, we are primarily now known as a Latino generation, a Latino race, or a Latino population group. Now, what the census doesn't do, and the census still has this all screwed up, frankly, is that it does not count us demographically, it counts us racially. And racially, we are not white. We are not African-American. And we are not Indian. We are a mixed group. But the census forces us in one question to identify racially, and that gets to be a mixed bag. And then on the other question, it has us counted as Hispanics. And under that question, then it has the subcategories of Hispanic, which are basically the categories of major countries, of Puerto Rico, Mexico, Colombia, etc.
I wanna just say to our audience listening that for the sake of the podcast, I will respect the terminology Latinx and do that for the trend in the United States to be inclusive. And Dr. Abdino Barrios is being inclusive. He is just following the Spanish language that you don't put an X at the end of any word. You just put an A or an O for the gender of the word. So I want to make that clarification to our audience that we're being inclusive of all in this conversation. So I want to make sure that we applaud our listeners and recognize them, Dr. Noboa, that they are professionals, they're staying at home, they're parents, they are some listeners who have lost their job during the COVID pandemic time. They've had to be more involved than ever at home in their children's education, supporting teachers, educating their children, and not knowing how, really. I mean, just basically being there as maybe babysitting, supervising that they turn on and off the computer, not to get into trouble. Our education system has now added a new layer of challenge in 2020 with this pandemic, this virus sweeping our nation. How do you see this pressing crisis in education and its relevance to your books?
Well, it's huge. There are pluses and there are minuses to what's going on. And I think it's important for us to emphasize the pluses. There is a silver lining to some of this in terms of the pandemic when it comes to education, because it's forcing the parent to be more involved in the educational process. That is good. The difficulty of that is that some parents do not have, number one, the capacity or the background. Number two, they're very afraid of the process because they've never done it before. So they don't know what to do.
Yeah, let me just interrupt you for a second.
A lot of parents, certainly a lot of our parents, are essential workers. So they are not always at home, or they cannot be always at home to work with that child. And fourthly, a lot of our children, and this is the negative side of it too, do not have access to the internet or have limited access. They certainly don't all have laptops at home. And so it becomes doubly difficult for them to catch up. And our concern is that a lot of them may not catch up and may have lost the entire year.
So I wanna add something, because I think you said it, but I just wanna clarify, you know, the parent that is not educated or literate sitting here at home that has a job as a laborer, et cetera, and cannot even support their child in math or reading, that's another layer, right? Like, we have parents who, like you mentioned, all the different situations, but we also have the adult parent that cannot support their student because they don't speak English or they're not literate. I mean, we have a problem. We have a crisis.
That's a huge crisis right now. And by the way, one that is not being very well attended. We need two things. One is we need orientation of parents on how to engage better with their children in the context of education. We also need to train teachers how to engage with parents to help parents in that process, because teachers don't know how either.
And another, you mentioned teachers, and I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but I do have to say, I've heard through my listeners that some teachers have been, you know, the retention of teachers is a big issue. Teachers are quitting left and right. They're not seen, like, they're essential workers, and maybe now they're in the limelight because of the pandemic, but teachers quit along the way, and this affects students. So that's a whole other conversation, probably a whole other challenge to discuss.
It is a big challenge, and what is happening is that a lot of these teachers are looking at other avenues for them. And by the way, the total number of Latino teachers in the US is about 8% of about 4.5 million teachers. Not a large number, because Latinos are over 20% right now of the entire US population. So it's not reflective of the population. And if we begin to lose more Latino teachers, we go back to what the statistics were 10, 15, 20 years ago. So we don't want to lose them. But at the same time, there are other opportunities now for those who have been teachers because of the new avenues for essential workers, and also more money. Teachers are not always being paid as they should adequately. The pay for the teacher profession is one of the lowest.
So you talk about 8% Latino teachers, but I say like the crisis is for all teachers. This is an American crisis. Yeah,
the crisis is for all teachers, but it often when we have crises, they seem to affect the Latino population and the African American population even more, for a variety of reasons. Crisis usually brings out the worst in our society, and the worst in our society affects the most disenfranchised even more greatly. And so it ends up being a double whammy in many respects.
Yeah, and our audience knows, I mean, the African American population and the minority students, especially the Latinos and African Americans, have been marginalized and discriminated against throughout history in public schools. And you talk a lot about that in your book. Do you want our listeners to see each of your recent books to stand on their own, or are you trying to build a body of work with connection between each book? Can you expand on what each book is meant to convey for our listeners?
They do stand on their own, but they're also bookends to a process. That is, book one was the history of the Latino and education in this country from the very beginning. I mean, I begin with Christopher Columbus, actually before Christopher Columbus, in terms of bringing that knowledge to bear. And I go through the period of colonization in the US, and certainly the Revolutionary War, and then the Civil War, and where Latinos were at in that process. Remember, that's a confusing history, and Latinos have been lost in that history in terms of our textbooks. So very few people know that history. But what happened
So what you're saying is that if the audience reads your book or through the podcast, we're distilling the information, but the audience needs to know the history so that they can understand what's going on in education. Is that what I hear you saying?
History is important because education basically is an outcome of what happens historically to a society, to a nation. And so, yeah, they're intertwined, and it's important to know the history, what has happened, why it has happened, and so what? What difference does that make? And so from that context, history becomes critical to know. It also gives a background to understanding why it is we are where we are today. Why is it that things are the way they are? They didn't just happen yesterday. There has been a process.
Right.
And as we know a fair amount, or a lot better now than we used to, about the African-American experience, we do not know that much about the Latino experience. And so that became very important for me to begin to discuss, to begin to analyze, to begin to share with others. So book one, going back to what
you question.
Asked, mm-hmm. Book one is about the history. Where have we been? Why are we where we are today? Book two then brings us into the 21st century. So now that we are here in the 21st century, what does it mean? Where are we? What are we? What can we do?
And so they stand alone, but there's definitely a connection between each book.
There's a connection between the two books. And so the second book really talks about, now that we are where we are, what exactly does this mean? What should we do? What can we do? What are the options right now? And by the way, the big thing between the two books is, if we continue to do things the way we used to do them, we ain't gonna get too very far.
And that's like the term of insanity, right?
Very well, and if we continue to use that old formula, we're gonna be in deep yogurt.
Right.
Next century.
But there are some great things that have happened in education. So not everything has been bad, right? I mean, I want to make sure that...
Not every 90% of it has been bad and 10% has been good. No, I actually, you can be both.
I don't agree with you there, but...
In every retrospective look, every time we look backwards, there are always good things that have happened. There always have been improvements. We cannot minimize that. And that's not what this is about. What this is about is how to make it better, how to make it more effective, how to make it so that we prosper even more and that we learn those lessons from history, from the past.
Welcome to our listeners who just joined us. Our listeners agree that providing high quality education to our children is a worthy cause to know about and to be well informed. There are many diverse viewpoints about what high quality education is and how high quality education should be accomplished for all the students, right? But we've just discussed how this is not a cookie cutter situation with children. We come from all backgrounds, et cetera. Understanding education issues is important for students, parents, and taxpayers. By being well-informed, we raise our level of awareness and we learn to contribute valuable input to the discussion. Listeners want to learn how to make better decisions about supporting educational challenges or about making educational plans for their future. What advice can you give our listeners?
In regards to?
To making better decisions about supporting these educational challenges that we're facing right now.
Well, one of them is to be involved, to be engaged in the process of education. And let me share something very personal. My mother never engaged when I was in elementary school in the States. And the reason why she did not was because she was very limited in English. The second reason was because she was a factory worker. She worked at Nabisco, baking cookies. And she didn't feel like she fit in with the parent organizations at the school. And so she, the PTA, and forgive me, I'm not knocking down PTA. I think PTA is wonderful. And by the way, PTA has changed considerably over the last decades. I'm talking about 5-6 decades ago.
Right.
It was a clubby group. Even though it was an inner city school, it was very clubby. And they did not want Puerto Ricans as part of the PTA group. And so—
But they were change makers. I mean, they made things happen in schools.
Yeah, and so mom did not feel comfortable in that kind of setting for both reasons. And at the same time, there were very few other Latinas involved in the PTA at that time. So mom was not part of that. And so my parent and my father was working like crazy, so he could never attend anything. And my mother was also working, so her attendance, should it have happened, would have been limited. So my parents, both working parents, working class, had to make it financially more than anything else. And so they were out of the educational sphere in participation. What made a difference years later was that my father left his job in the factory. He was making fans in a factory as part of an assembly line of workers. And he eventually went to school at night and as a result, decided to work later in the community and became a social worker, actually a community worker, because he didn't have the credentials for social work, and became very active in the community. Now, at that point, I was already finishing high school and going into college. And so the engagement.
And you were proving your principle wrong all along.
That's right. It was born at the wrong time in the wrong place. So eventually, that changed for the rest of my family, but not during my epoch. But that was a lesson, and my mother and I talked about it for many years later, that it would have been, and it has to be important for our parents to be more engaged in the educational process. Mm-hmm. And my mother many times told me, had I known what I know now, I would have acted very differently. But at the same time, I'm not even sure that she could have, because of the fact that she was working 45 hours a week.
And culturally, in the Latino, and we're grouping everyone together, which is probably not a good thing to do, but overall, I've noticed that the culturally Latino parents do not cross the door into the public school, you know, house. They stay on the outside and they receive information. It's been through the years that through PTAs, through changes in organizations, through parent involvement movements, that the cultural aspect of getting involved has shifted a little bit, and that parents are understanding the importance of it.
Yeah, because I have as an educational researcher many years later, I have gone to, I would say, more than several hundred schools across the country. And I have come to the determination that part of the problem, or actually most of the problem, ends up being at the door of the school, at the door of the administration of local schools, because they do not extend, many, again, we have to be careful in generalizations.
Right, right.
Many do not extend themselves the way that they should to welcome the Latino parent or the African-American parent or the minority parent or whatever that parent may be. They do not welcome an inclusive process of engagement. And when they do, they don't always walk through what that process means. Mm-hmm. And do not always help that process. I remember on a number of occasions where it was important for school members, whether they were staff, administrative staff, or teachers, going into neighborhoods. And most of them were afraid of the very neighborhoods that their school was in, because they would travel 45 minutes from afar to work at that school, but rapidly try to beat the rush hour going back home, never engaged with their school. And these teachers were afraid to even visit.
And on the other hand, we do have a lot of teachers that have overextended themselves, that reach out, that visit children, that go home to homes, that communicate always, with parents.
There are always exceptions to this rule, but I'm talking generally right now. And I was a high school principal not all that long ago.
So I want us to stop right here.
My own teachers to do some home visitations. And some of them were even Latino teachers, very few in this case, but I had to wrestle with the teachers in terms of bringing them into the community to get involved with the community, to get involved with parents.
Thank you, Dr. Abdino Barrios.
I'm talking about the experience also. So we have to be careful not to generalize, but at the same time, generalization is very important.
Because we need to stop our conversation here. It's getting heated, it's getting exciting, and we need to we need to keep our audience excited to tune in next week to continue the conversation with Dr. Abdin Nawawa. We've talked about the shifts in demographics. We've talked about the Latino terminology. We've talked about, you know, the crisis the pandemic has brought to our homes, educating students in the homes with parents who really have very little or limited capacity while working or losing their jobs to support the students. Dr. Abdin Nawawa Rios, it has been a pleasure speaking to you. Please, audience, visit the dumasgroup.com, DOMASGROUP.com. Go to the education page, follow our conversations with Dr. Nawawa Rios there. Click on his book link and purchase it, because there's nothing like reading the book yourself. Or go directly to abdingnawawa.com to learn more about the two books. Again, that's abdinnoboa.com. Learn more about the two books, Latinos in Education in American History and Critical Issues of Latinos in Education in the 21st Century America. Where are we? Thank you so much to our listeners.
It's been fun engaging. It's been fun dialoguing. It's been fun even having tete-a-tete, because that's what this is all about.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks.